Iran says the U.S. has failed to take any step that would ensure the Iranian nation reap the economic benefits of the JCPOA. The U.S. deploys more troops to Poland as Ukraine plays down Western speculations of a potential Russian invasion of the country. And the African Union condemns what it calls the wave of unconstitutional changes of government in the bloc's member states. I'm Behrouz Najafi. Welcome. A top Iranian security official says Tehran will enter no agreement in the Vienna talks on the 2015 accord that does not end the U.S. maximum pressure campaign of sanctions. Secretary of the Supreme National Security Council, Ali Shamkhani, says any agreement that does not remove the bans that could not be a basis for a verifiable deal. Shamkhani says this has been clearly laid out as Iran's agenda for the continuation of the eighth round of talks. The comments came as Iran and the P4 plus one countries are preparing to resume the talks on the revival of the accord in Vienna. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman says the talks need to lead to the removal of anti-Iran sanctions.
If the other parties, especially the U.S., officially announce during the future talks in Vienna that they will fulfill their commitments and offer the needed guarantees, and if the U.S. removes the sanctions within the framework of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the day after that, an agreement will be reached.
Al-Khatibzadeh noted that the recent move by the U.S. to resume waivers on other countries' nuclear cooperation with Iran is of little importance. The spokesman said that this has nothing to do with Iran's main demand, that's ensuring the nation would reap the economic benefits of the 2015 deal. On that aside, that the U.S. has an important political decision to make.
The administration of U.S. President Joe Biden has provided some sanctions relief to the countries that had nuclear cooperation with Iran under the terms of the 2015 multilateral agreement. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken on Friday signed several sanctions waivers related to the 2015 Iran deal, also known as the JCPOA. The waiver covered the conversion of Iran's Arak heavy water reactor, the provision of enriched uranium for its Tehran research reactor, and the transfer of a spent and scrap reactor fuel abroad. The exemptions allow foreign companies to resume cooperation with Iran on its nuclear projects. The waivers are part of the 2015 accord. They were canceled by former U.S. President Donald Trump after he withdrew from the agreement in 2018 and reimposed anti-Iran sanctions. The latest U.S. move reverses the Trump administration's decision and lifts the sanctions threat against foreign countries and companies from Russia, China, and Europe that had been cooperating with Iran under the terms of the JCPOA. The media cited a U.S. State Department report as saying that the step is meant to facilitate the Vienna talks on the revival of the agreement. Meanwhile, the waiver announcement prompted hawks in Washington to accuse the Biden administration of giving concessions without securing any commitments from Iran. Senator Bob Menendez has asked that the president adopt a tougher position on Iran. He called for new efforts, including creative diplomatic initiatives, stricter sanctions enforcement, and determination from Congress to support President Biden's declaration that Iran will never get a nuclear weapon on my watch, something that Iran has repeatedly denied seeking. In addition, these waivers will not entail financial relief to Iran, though there remains a strong case for upfront humanitarian relief as it is the people of Iran who have suffered the most under U.S. sanctions. Iran and the remaining signatories to the JCPOA are set to resume talks in Vienna. Iran says an agreement hinges on the removal of U.S. sanctions and guarantees that Washington won't pull out of the deal again. Iran says there have been positive developments in the JCPOA revival talks in Vienna, but they do not fulfill Tehran's expectations. Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian says the 2015 nuclear deal hasn't had any economic benefits for Iran in recent years. Amir Abdullahian says Tehran is firmly and explicitly seeking a good deal that would guarantee Iran's economic benefits reliably and sustainably.
I think it is a symbolic speech. So I think the Joe Biden administration can do better than that, and by starting to lift all the sanctions on the frozen huge amount of money. We're talking about tens of billions of dollars frozen in foreign banks that belong to Iran, and that will be a positive step, not a symbolic step.
U.S. Special Envoy for Iran Robert Malley has said that Washington cannot guarantee the next administration's adherence to the Iran deal. At the same time, Secretary General of Iran's National Security Council, Ali Shamkhani, has had important messages for the opposing side. First, that even in the event of a deal, Iran will still pursue its civilian nuclear program. And secondly, Tehran will adhere to its stance that there needs to be a verifiable lifting of sanctions.
A day after the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden restored a sanctions waiver, which was rescinded by his predecessor Donald Trump in May 2020, Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian said Washington must show goodwill on the ground, not on paper. He also said, "We demanded the guarantee at all political, legal, and economic levels. Agreements have been reached in some areas, but the Iranian negotiating team will seriously pursue getting tangible guarantees from the Western sides that they will abide by their commitments under a Vienna deal." That's in reaction to recent comments by U.S. Special Envoy for Iran, Robert Malley, who said Washington cannot guarantee the next administration's adherence to the JCPOA. Iran has time and again stated that one of its main issues is to get the necessary guarantees from the other parties, especially from the West in the Vienna talks.
Well, there is no guarantee for Iran that even Joe Biden, after the signature of this deal that is going to be signed or will be signed and soon, perhaps in the next couple of months, is going to be respected. There are no guarantees that the U.S. is going to respect the deal, and certainly no guarantee that the next administration will abide by it.
Also, Iran's top security official Ali Shamkhani says real, effective, and verifiable economic benefits for Iran are a necessary condition to reach an agreement in Vienna. He said making a pretense of lifting sanctions is not considered to be constructive. He added that Iran has the legal right to continue developing peaceful nuclear capabilities. His comments came as Iran is now awaiting a political decision by the U.S. and European countries for a breakthrough in the sanctions revival talks in Vienna.
More U.S. troops arrive in southeastern Poland following an order by President Joe Biden, and that's the latest development in the ongoing standoff between the West and Moscow over Ukraine. Over the past few days, a series of U.S. elite forces, advance groups, and military vehicles arrived in an airport near the Polish border with Ukraine. On Friday, Biden called for the deployment of 3,000 extra troops to Poland and Romania. The measures follow Western accusations that Russia is planning an invasion of Ukraine. The Eastern European country says it does not believe such predictions, but is prepared to face any development with the help of international assistance. Russia dismisses the allegations, saying that Washington is trying to drag it into a war by creating tensions near Russian borders. Now, we've asked journalist Dmitry Zolotarev to share with us his perspective on the current standoff. He says that the United States is using Ukraine as a pretext to impose more sanctions on Russia.
As I see it, it's just another show off from the world champion of lies, the United States government. The fact is, they just using any pretext to impose more sanctions or pressure on Russia. So they create fake allegations, absolutely not unsubstantiated, to show in the Western media that Russia is preparing to full-scale war and wants to destroy Ukraine, so on and so forth. The fact is that all those moves of the United States troops to Europe is just another way of the United States and NATO to come closer to Russian borders.
The African Union denounces a recent wave of military coup d'etat sweeping the continent, saying that military governments would not be tolerated.
Every African leader in the assembly has condemned unequivocally the pattern of, or the resurgence, or the cycle, or the wave of unconstitutional changes of government.
Adeyuye says that this is the first time that four countries were suspended from the bloc in a 12-month period. He was speaking at the end of the two-day African Union summit in Ethiopian capital. The chair of the EU Commission, Moussa Faki Mohamed, also warned of a democratic backpedaling in the continent, saying this is unacceptable. Less than 2 weeks before the summit began Saturday, Burkina Faso became the fourth country to be suspended from the bloc after Guinea, Mali, and Sudan. The AU has, however, been accused of double the standard by not suspending Chad after a military council takeover. Analysts also say that the body must be more proactive to prevent putches. Elsewhere in the world, the mayor of the Canadian capital, Ottawa, has declared a state of emergency to deal with truckers' days-long demonstrations there. Jim Watson says the protesters camped out in the capital far outnumber the police and control the situation. He says it's the protesters that are, quote, calling the shots now. He made a comment as a demonstration against COVID vaccine mandates has clogged parts of the city for a 10th day. Similar protests have been held in other cities, such as Toronto and Quebec. A movement called Freedom Convoy began on January 22nd against the Canadian vaccine requirement for cross-border truckers. It quickly turned into protests against COVID restrictions and the government of Prime Minister Trudeau. Organizers say that they're expecting their numbers to swell into tens of thousands. Well, Jason Nruha joined a short time ago, and he believes the Canadian truckers' protests have steered toward a racist anti-government agenda, possibly thanks to funding from far-right groups.
The way this was set up originally was that it was supposed to be against vaccines. But this turned into very much an anti-Trudeau protest. It's being heavily funded by unknown sources. All three main leaders, particularly Patrick King, have gone on record as saying horribly racist things, including accusing First Nations people of essentially being degenerate. This has taken on a very clear far right-wing agenda, one that is incredibly racist. It's very anti-immigration. Like I said, there have been numerous public statements that are frighteningly racist coming out of the protesters and the leaders of the movement themselves. Their blatant disregard for public health, which is a problem that affects everybody. So I think that this may have been started by perhaps two or three people who were anti-vax, pushing some kind of vaccine conspiracy theory, and it gained popular support from very far-right figures, many racists, white supremacists, etc., and feeling emboldened by the public displays that they've managed to get away with, they've managed to come together and be an even larger force.
Iran's Islamic Revolution is being recalled globally by those who are of age to witness its immediate impact, and for others who continue to feel its international legacy. Amina Taylor has a report from London.
It is the revolution that continues to reverberate around the globe. Iran's Islamic Revolution ushering in a new age by ousting the US-backed Pahlavi regime. Father Frank Gelli, who became an ordained minister, recalls his initial reaction when news of the revolution broke.
At the time, I considered myself quite left-wing, so I enjoyed the idea there should be a revolution against the Shah. I considered the Shah a tyrant.
One of the most inspirational things about the Islamic Revolution for its many admirers is not just the impact that it's had inside of Iran, but it's the growing legacy that it continues to build globally.
For political observers, Iran's stoic path proved an innovative and bold new model where alliances could be forged and solidarity fostered.
Because of its anti-imperialistic values, that's why Iran has good relations with lots of other countries around the world, Muslim and non-Muslim, that have also suffered colonialism and occupation. I mean, it could be Cuba, it could be Venezuela, many countries in Africa around the world who, you know, have a certain affinity with Iran because of that.
There's also another element to those who admire the aims and accomplishments of the revolution.
The Iranian revolution, as I mentioned, it tells us how you don't have to have only one model of a political system whereby, I mean, here in this country, we have a monarch who is head of a national church, but it's a farce. In reality, God has been pushed out of the public sphere, and so the whole thing is a charade. In Iran, there is a valuable presence of faith in the public sphere.
As the revolution moves towards another remarkable milestone, the West still continues its opposition campaign despite a lack of success.
I can't think of too many examples of countries around the world that have withstood the barrage of war, sanctions, media hatred, internal subterfuge, kind of instigated from outside, that Iran has. Yet they're still here, and they're not just surviving by the skin of their teeth, they're thriving as well. They have a strong military. They have strong regional allies. They have political influence, especially within their area in the Middle East. I think that it's widely recognized, even by haters of Iran, that Iran is one of the major regional players.
With its legacy still rippling across the globe, supporters of the Islamic Revolution internationally know they owe Iran and Iranians a great debt. Amina Taylor, London.
The Islamic Revolution in 1979 replaced Iran's monarchy with an Islamic establishment that has been governing the country ever since. Najum Abdullahi reports on the effect of the revolution in Nigeria.
When the Iranian Islamic Revolution took place in 1979, prominent Nigerian Islamic cleric Sheikh Ibrahim Al-Zazaki was a young university student preaching against immorality. He says that the 1979 Islamic Revolution in Iran and the leader of the revolution, Imam Khomeini, were sources of inspiration to many young Nigerians.
It makes us, you know, it boosts our morale and it makes us feel that what we have been yearning and aspiring is realizable, is possible since it has been realized elsewhere. The success of the revolution was a turning point in modern history.
Professor Sadiq Abba was also a young student who cared about the common good for all Nigerians and said that the Islamic Revolution was based on knowledge and the collective willpower on the Iranian people.
The Iranian Revolution is a revolution that sprang up to address global injustice, global inequalities, and global socioeconomic exploitation and expropriations by the Western world.
Dr. Imam Mukhtar says the 1979 Islamic Revolution was a change that was inspired by Iranians who have had enough.
It was a unique revolution that was led and driven by individuals, groups, young people and all the like, who saw a frustration with the system, which was with the Shah regime, which was not only pro-West, but then subduing the people within the domestic environment. And it was a collective responsibility.
Experts believe that one of the significant outcomes of the 1979 Islamic Revolution was turning Iran into a power in the Middle East region with even influence in global affairs. Danjuma Abdullahi, Abuja.
Epic. Epic. Glory. Honor. This is Bahman, the month which reminds us of love and empathy.
very heart of evergreen forests. Under the starry sky of the desert. With the radiance of silver-colored sand. In the midst of proud mountains. Closer, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. Oh my God, so scary. Oh no, I can't continue watching this movie anymore. I'd better turn off the television. Watching a horrific movie at this time of the night was not a good idea. Oh, even the clock's ticking scares me. My constant fear may have its roots in my tomorrow's trip to the Lake of Ghosts. Mamra's Lake, or the Lake of Ghosts, is located 32 kilometers from the city of Nushahr and is in proximity of Salaheddin Kala village. The local name for this lake is Mamra's, but it is better known by the name the Lake of Ghosts, given it in reference to its eerie swampland landscape featuring countless half-drowned trees, often shrouded in mist, giving them the appearance of phantoms. Mamra's Lake, or the Lake of Ghosts, is actually a natural historical phenomenon. This lake has been registered nationally in order to preserve its animal and plant species. The lake's surface and its surroundings are covered with alder and hornbeam trees. The hornbeam tree, with the scientific name of Carpinus betulus, is a tree species native to Iran. The height of this tree can reach between 15 and 25 meters. It has a trunk bearing a smooth gray-green bark. The dead or moribund specimens protruding from the lake have suffered considerable decay from having been partially submerged in its waters for many years. I am now on a beautiful forest route. To reach the Lake of Ghosts, I have to walk 15 kilometers. This forest is amazing, and the sound of birds has doubled its beauty. Thank God I haven't seen anything scary up to now. It's just tall trees and the sound of birds. My God, what a wonderful scenery. I am now covered with a heavy fog. Weird remains of trunks in the middle of the lake. It's more astonishing rather than being a scary place. You know, the Lake of Ghosts is an unspoiled natural place, so it's home to wild animals like fox, boar, as well as wild dogs. I won't get close to the surrounding areas of the lake. This lake is also home to different species of fish, frog, and snake. Well, I have to leave before it's too late. Honestly, the sound of animals and the eerie scenery is frightening me. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of instrument.
The Spotlight.
Israel's membership at the AU, the African Union, has become a source of controversy. The African Union has suspended a debate on whether to withdraw Israel's accreditation. This is happening despite growing calls on the bloc to overturn last year's decision to grant Israel an observer status. Why the controversy? Overall, many African Union member countries consider Israel an apartheid regime. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at Israel's intentions behind its desire to be an AU member, especially in the context of so-called normalization.
Israel once again at the heart of an international rift and controversy, this time within a usually united body valuing consensus, the African Union. A row so fierce that the bloc was forced to suspend a debate on whether to rescind Israel's observer status and postpone a potentially divisive vote. The rare dispute within the 55-member body was set in motion last July. That's when Moussa Faki Mahamat, the chairman of the African Union Commission, unilaterally accepted Israel's accreditation to the bloc. A slew of criticism followed. Powerful members, including South Africa and Algeria, were among the many protesting that the decision had been taken without consultations. They also argued that the decision flew in the face of African Union statements supporting the Palestinian territories. The AU has called for an end to the Israeli occupation and an independent Palestinian state, with East Al-Quds as its capital. Israel received AU observer status after 20 years of diplomatic efforts. The quest is largely seen as part of the regime's US-backed campaign to normalize ties with African and Arab countries such as Morocco, Sudan, the UAE, and Bahrain. But analysts believe the normalization does not enjoy popular support.
Of course, Israel has hitherto been, of course, unaccepted in Asia or in West Asia. And although you've got clandestinely nations like Saudi Arabia who have been dealing with it, and others more overt, like Jordan and Egypt, etc., you've nonetheless got this kind of fear amongst leaderships in West Asia, even now, of openly becoming part of the Israeli syndicate. Because the people, ultimately at the grassroots, certainly the Arab people, are not happy with the idea of Israel being accepted.
Palestine gained observer status at the African Union in 2013. Its Prime Minister, Mohamed Shtayyeh, addressed the bloc's latest summit held at the weekend. He called for Israel's accreditation to be revoked.
Israel should never be rewarded for its violation and for the apartheid regime it does impose on the Palestinian people. As an entity, Israel has progressed from extremism to militarism to colonial expansion. This must stop.
Resistance movement Hamas has also slammed granting Israel the observer status. Hamas says the move is a flagrant violation of the principles and statute of the African Union, which reject racism and demand decolonization and the right to self-determination. The African body has now set up a 6-country committee to review Israel's observer status and submit its findings during an assembly next year, a decision that will ultimately come down to whether or not the bloc will stick to its anti-colonial and anti-racist principles.
Our guest joining us for this edition of The Spotlight, Hafsa Kara Mustafa, is a journalist and Middle East expert. She joins us from London. Also joining us, Netfa Freeman, Pan-African Community Action, Black Alliance for Peace, joins us from Washington, D.C.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Hafsa Kara Mustafa, let me start with you, and if you can give us a backdrop as to what is going on here, what's the controversy all about? We understand Moussa Faki Mohammed, the chair of the African Union Commission, accepted Israel's defense status in the bloc without consultations from what we understand, and maybe that is what sort of put the spotlight on this and then create the controversy. But what exactly has happened?
Well, the controversy actually stems from the fact that many peoples across the African continent refuse to recognize or acknowledge the legitimacy of the State of Israel. Obviously, Arab countries are opposed to it in solidarity with the Palestinian people, but of course, the African continent itself has suffered from colonialism and therefore understands the plight of the Palestinian people and is not in solidarity at all with Israel in general terms. There are obviously pockets here and there where there's been influence from Christian fundamentalists, American Christian fundamentalists across the continent that have influenced various communities to go towards supporting the State of Israel. But in general terms, of course, across the continent, there is consensus that colonialism is wrong, is morally reprehensible, and therefore, because Israel represents the last, in fact, colonial outpost in the region, it has to be opposed. So the controversy stems first from actually taking this decision, second, obviously, unilaterally, but of course, again, because it goes against the Charter of the African Union, which recognizes that before any moves towards normalization with Israel in general terms
has to be made on condition that Palestinian rights be respected, and of course that isn't the case. On the background, obviously, to this, there are many issues happening behind the scenes, in particular in the way Israeli companies are actually looking to get a foothold in the numerous sectors of natural resources of countries like, for instance, Congo or Rwanda, hence the move for normalization and for increased presence, Israeli presence, should I say, across the African continent.
Sure. You just went through five of our questions here that I was going to ask, but that's okay. Let's expand on all of them. The one that really struck me, aside from the fact that this observer status was introduced, is the one about the charter. So let me ask you, Netva Freeman, you have a charter of the African Union that is well known to its member countries, but yet you have the chair of the African Union Commission to have accepted Israel's observer status. This was going to come out anyways, you know, so why did this proceed? Of course, Hafez Kamil Mustafa gave us some very good reasons, but you give us yours.
Mm. Well, I think that this whole thing, you know, the accreditation of Israel to the African Union should have never been considered, and it actually reflects the full-blown subservience of the African Union to neocolonialism. The previous speaker was talking about colonialism, and we have to look at the specific forms of colonialism. That most of the member states, they're not representing the wishes and the sentiments of the masses of the people in their different countries. And so it also reflects the fact that these countries are really not people-centered democracies, and that Africa used to be the vanguard of global solidarity with Palestinians and against Zionism and settler colonialism. And so the charter is really, you know, like the UN Charter and like the US Constitution and all these things are circumvented, are just sidelined by the powers that be in the world. If you look at contradictions, like for the fact that Haiti, actually, you know, pretty much an African country, you know, can't even enjoy or be regarded with accreditation to the African Union, it shows that the charter means very little when it comes to leveling the power of the global dominance that characterizes white supremacy and settler colonialism in the world.
So, Hafez Kamil Mustafa, we have the fact that you mentioned, and our guest there from Washington, D.C. also mentioned, how Israel is shunned by many of the African countries. And I'd like to know the percentage, if you can state that. But I'm sure Israel is aware of that also. So what happened is we had this so-called normalization occur. I'm wondering if the normalization was a prelude to Israel being accepted in return for, I'm not too sure, economic perhaps dividends of some kind coming from Israel. Is that what the African countries were promised in return? Is that how it went down, do you think?
It depends of each different country. In the case of Sudan, for instance, we know that Sudan was going through a major financial crisis, and therefore it was promised financial support from the U.S. in exchange for normalization. We know that other countries, for instance, if you take the RDC, for instance, which has the largest reserves of copper in the continent and actually across the world, we have various interests, and that's the most important thing, actually, diamond mines in the region. We know, if you take on board the fact that Tel Aviv is the main platform for diamond exchange, then you will know that the relation with Africa, that actually Israel is dependent on African resources, but because African governments are in turmoil in these regions, they're actually having to depend on Western companies, or in this case, Israeli companies, to trade their products. And so there's this sort of unhealthy relationship that has developed between African governments, which are in turmoil, which are very often corrupt, and these countries such as Israel or the U.S. I mean, it's difficult to differentiate between the two because they obviously both work in the same sense, in terms of destroying African economies, keeping the continent in constant turmoil in order to exploit its natural resources. So when we go back to what the root causes of this desire for normalization, it is to get a hand on African resources, but of course also to increase the normalization, because the more countries normalize with Israel, the more legitimacy Israel feels it has, and therefore feels that its presence is no longer a threatened in any way, shape, or form.
So this legitimacy that Hafez Kamil Mustafa mentions, Netfa Freeman, is something that it needs to be recognized by the African countries. Unfortunately, we know that many African governments, I'm not going to say a lot, but many of them are known to be corrupt. But I'm wondering what kind of pressure may be exerted on the governments to accept Israel into their mainstream, I guess, business, so that they can not only reap the rewards off their corruption, but also then have Israel come in, and again, as our guest on London said, to somewhat take advantage of the natural resources, number one being at the top of the list, again, as our guest in London said.
Mm-hmm. Well, we know that the United States has been the biggest supporter of Israel throughout its existence, and gives, you know, lots of financial support to Israel, and that has been behind some of the pressures exerting on some of the countries, like, for example, with Sudan was mentioned. And one of the things that alleviates Sudan's economic issue is that it being on the terrorist list. So that was a promise that was given to United. That was, I guess, a promise or a negotiated thing between primarily the United States and Sudan. So the United States is really behind some of these maneuvers. We also know that a lot of the United Nations resolutions in the General Assembly, you know, that Israel doesn't get enough support, largely a lot of times because some of these, despite their corruption, that their resolutions are things are not voted for, the things that would favor Israel. These kind of moves also take alleviate the isolation of Israel and Zionism, the exposure of Zionism as an inhumane system. And so these are the kind of things that happen. I think also we can't take Israel out of the global context of, and I would consider desperation of white supremacy and the pan-European project of really trying to hold international dominance, and particularly its competition with other forces in the world, China, Russia. And so it's trying to shore up as much as it can, or sway as much as it can, its influence, and Israel is a big part of that. A lot of Israel behind the scenes in terms of how the United States dominates the continent of Africa through military arms sales and things like that. A lot of that, Israel's involved in those kind of things. And then, like we say, the international trade through diamonds and those types of things are very important. But we can't underestimate the role that the Western countries, particularly the United States, plays in this scenario.
Sure. Well, as we go through our daily lives, Hafsakar Mustafa, Israel is doing a fantastic job of violating the Palestinian rights. And recently, there was a 280-page report that talks about how Israel, in a matter of just summarizing it, is an apartheid regime. So Israel is racking up its report card very well with these types of not only violations, but also reports that come out condemning it to that effect. Doesn't that make it very difficult for organizations like the AU to even consider having Israel come on board?
Well, I think the fact that they've had this latest decision proves that they've realized the massive mistake and are sort of trying to backtrack from it. I think it's a good sign that pressure was exercised on the AU Council to actually rescind the invitation. And so I think that the added pressure coming from Western NGOs can only make the case stronger. I mean, I think it's a bit sad that we'd have to rely on Western NGOs to actually make a case for Palestinian oppression or for the apartheid nature of the Israeli regime. But I think that does go some way in saying that even if countries that are normally friendly towards Israel are now acknowledging that it's a racist entity, that it practices apartheid, that means that there is no excuse for countries who've suffered from apartheid, who've suffered from colonialism, to actually engage in any way with a terrorist entity such as Israel.
Yeah, I'd like to get some reflections here on some people who are well-known within the Israeli community and their account of what apartheid is. And Netha Freeman, let me quote here Yossi Sarid, a former Israeli cabinet minister, ex-leader of the opposition, a member of the Knesset for 32 years, who back in 2008 said, quote, "What acts like apartheid, is run like apartheid, and harasses like apartheid is not a duck. It is apartheid." And there's been many Israeli, political figures who have also led a hand in categorizing Israel as an apartheid regime. Ehud Barak, Ehud Olmert, they all talked about it also in those with a similar stance. So if you have Israeli officials labeling Israel itself as an apartheid regime, then that says something, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. It says something. It's really, and the apartheid as a system can be obscured by the normalization of countries like the United States. The United States is an apartheid country. It's a settler colony, but people don't see it that way. But because of the, I think we could call the increasing fascist nature and the untenable situation in Israel as, you know, illegitimate state, then there are those who have to acknowledge, you know, what is done. I don't even, it's hard to even say the increased fascism, because it's really, Israel really has just really existed on this type of behavior or foundation ever since its existence. But at this point, I think the world is waking up to the natures and fundamental nature of Zionism and what it really entails, that it is racism, that it is settler colonialism, which in fact is apartheid in a statutory way. And so, yes, I think it says a lot, but it's also reflective of the increasing illegitimacy, crisis of legitimacy that Israel's facing along with the rest of the Western nations.
Hafsakar Mustafa, the possibilities of what we're looking at in Africa in terms of the U.S. involvement. Our guest talked about it, Netva Freeman. You know, we're witnessing an Africa that's somewhat unstable in the past, over a year now. We've witnessed 7 coups that have happened here. Now, I'm not saying there's a direct relationship between the coups and the U.S., but overall, we have some Western traces in some of these coups. France has been actually, accused of it when it comes to countries like Mali. But what my question is there a possibility that the U.S., and then in turn, maybe by default, Israel, sees opportunities when it comes to instability in certain African countries to try to move in and then have Israel obviously be introduced to these countries?
Well, absolutely. I think turmoil is essential to Western economies, and I don't mean just for the US or Israel. I think for all Western countries, because all countries across the world, in fact, are reliant on African resources. It's not just copper, it's not just gold, it's not just diamond, it's also uranium, it's also a whole plethora of things that exist only on the African continent, that are essential for computers, for nuclear technology, for all these things that are only found on the continent. So it is essential to keep African markets going. But of course, in order to keep prices down, the ideal scenario is to have the African countries in constant turmoil. Once they're in constant turmoil, once they're constantly embroiled in civil conflict, in wars, in coups, they can't control the markets, they can't control the prices of the products that they're exporting, and therefore they're reliant completely on Western countries buying at the prices that they deem fit, which is why you will always find a Western imprint on any coup, on any civil conflict that is occurring on Africa. Whether we like it or not, it isn't some sort of conspiracy theory about a foreign hand. There is always a Western hand in any scenario that has taken place in the last 50 years on the continent, precisely to keep the prices of the natural resources down and allow Western markets to exploit African resources.
One of the headlines that I'd like to ask you, Netva Freeman, is the UAE taking steps to gain control of Sudan's main port. Now, there is an intense cooperation and collaboration, I should say, between the UAE and Israel when it comes to Yemen, on the southern side, I guess, Socotra Island, and then that main waterway there. And it is said this collaboration is somewhat the spark to have Israel and the UAE move along African ports and try to, I guess, take control of them, as we can see here. Whether together or whether separately, I'm not sure. This particular headline talks about the UAE doing that. Do you think then that the so-called normalization with Israel would be characterized by these types of actions?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is all in line with trying to shore up Israel's ability and influence as a player on the African continent. I don't want to claim to know enough about this particular issue, so I haven't studied that issue enough. I know that, but obviously it's clear that, you know, United Arab Emirates and Yemen, and what's happening there is supported by the West, and that they want, and it has a lot to do with resources, like the other guest is saying, a lot of it has to do with resources. But I will say this about, and if I can comment on the last question, I agree with everything our other guest is saying. I would add, though, that when it comes to the coups on the continent of Africa, it's a bit more complicated in the sense that the neocolonialism is becoming untenable by the masses of the people, and you'll see that some of the people are cheering on some of the coups when they take place. So it's not just a matter of the militaries that are trained by French Foreign Legion or AFRICOM or something, but it's also the masses of the people who are actually decrying the neocolonial, the comprador class, and that the military, the emboldened military class, is taking advantage of that. But there's a groundswell, particularly in the French former colonies, against neocolonialism, and that also is a factor that cannot be ignored.
Sure. Habsakar Mustafa, I'm going to ask the same question to you, because I believe that this actually has some depth to it when it comes to the Israeli and the UAE collaboration. It really appears like, and I'm sifting through some of these headlines, that this is a collaboration that is very deep, and that they are citing the fact that together they want to move down into African ports, perhaps. Sudan is one of them that the UAE in particular has gone through. We know UAE has been involved in Africa, for example, in Libya and elsewhere. So the normalization is a good way, just like the Israel becoming an AU, which at this point has been rescinded, I guess observer status membership is rescinded, that the normalization will lead to that. Is that what we're looking at in that context?
Well, absolutely. I mean, you mentioned the islands of Socotra and the south of Yemen. These are major, major trade routes that have been responsible for the prosperity of East Africa, the Arabian Peninsula, and even further up towards India and Iran. So these are incredibly important routes. And if the Israelis get a foothold in these straits that are very, very strategic for commerce in this area, this is extraordinarily dangerous for the stability of the region, because we know that obviously Israel has no principle. It is a terrorist regime, and it will do whatever it takes for its own interests, including destabilize entire regions just to get a foothold and a control of these very important strategic routes. So it's a very, very dangerous development, and it shows the depth of collaboration with the UAE, and also, again, the subservience of the UAE towards Israel. The question now is how far the UAE is willing to go, and why is it going this far? Because obviously, if we can understand, and I'm not in any way justifying the Sudanese decision, but if we can understand that economic uncertainty has pushed Sudan in this direction, there is no valid reason for the UAE to actually engage so closely with Israel, given that its economy is doing extraordinarily well. So there is something afoot going on here. It's very difficult to establish what the reason is, but absolutely, it is a very, very dangerous development for the stability of the region and for the African continent as well.
Okay, thank you very much. We're going to end it there. Habsakar Mustafa, thank you for your input. Journalist and Middle East expert from London. And Netfa Freeman, thank you. Pan-African Community Action, Black Alliance for Peace from Washington, D.C. Thank you for your input. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Vitakway and the entire team here in the capital, Tehran, it's goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave radio, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the Internet. Our Internet address is pastoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran. Or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
This man changed the world.
Allahu Akbar, Khomeini Rahbar. Allahu Akbar, Khomeini Rahbar.
Our bosses couldn't cope with the idea of an 80-year-old Ayatollah, which they didn't even know what an Ayatollah was, who lived on garlic and onions and yogurt, directing a revolution that was about to topple America's most important ally.
Shuma dar in qarn mojza kardid. ملت ایران ملت معجزه آسای قرن است.
الله اکبر خمینی رهبر. الله اکبر خمینی رهبر.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحیم. In the name of Allah, the exalted, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Salam, hello and welcome to our audience, and a warm welcome to our listeners of our program, The Man Who Changed the World. This is a program dedicated to the life and times of Imam Khomeini. May God bless his great soul. And I'm your host on this program, Ijaz Hussain. And the expert I have to discuss this, as usual, on the life and times of Imam Khomeini, may God bless his great soul, is Dr. Mahdi Tarabi, good friend, academic scholar, and Islamic scholar as well. A very warm welcome to you, sir. Salam and hello.
Alaykum salam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for inviting me.
Dr. Mahdi Tarabi, we are looking at the Imam's will.
Mm-hmm.
Give us the analysis, if you like, the thinking behind why is it so essential that we Muslims must be united.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Let's look at what he said in this quote. Unfortunately, in the hands of conniving enemies and ignorant friends, the Holy Quran, this divine book that is empowered to decide man's destiny, has found no place anywhere except in graveyards and at gatherings of the dead, for the dead, although technically also of the dead.
Of the dead, of course, yes.
The instrument Absolutely, that was to unite Muslims and all mankind, the instrument that was to unite Muslims and all mankind.
Yes. And all mankind.
Listen, Imam is, you know, it's his last will. So he's being hardcore.
He's very hardcore.
He's not even...
And because when he says all mankind, of course the Quran is for all humanity, for all time.
Right.
Whether we are believers or not is immaterial.
Right. The instrument that was to unite the Muslims and all mankind and serve as the scripture for their lives and salvation has turned into an instrument of division and dispute among men, or it has left the arena entirely. We all witnessed that whoever spoke of Islamic rule or of politics, which is the major role of Islam and its prophet, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, or of the Quran and the Islamic traditions, was regarded as one who had committed a grave sin. The term Ahund Siyasi,